When you think work, you think boots. You think boots, you think Ariat. You think grit, concrete, rain, and heat. And boots that never back down from any of it. You think comfort and durability that hold up on the job, off the clock, and every step in between. Because the day doesn't end when the job does. And from overtime to off-duty, you're thinking Ariat boots. Boots that show up, stand out, and always back you up. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find yours at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.
Welcome to the Squawker Talker podcast. I'm your host, Greg Johnson. Joining me today is Greg Stobart.
Hello, Greg.
Hello. Adrian Kajumba from the Daily Mirror.
Hello, Greg. How are you doing?
I'm not bad, not bad. And Hosh Karai, how are you doing, Hosh?
I'm good, Greg. Thanks for having me on again.
No problem. No problem at all. Obviously, we've just seen the League Cup games in midweek, or the EFL Cup, as we're calling it these days. Bit of a shame. The highlight of the draw for the round of 16 is going to be the Manchester Derby. Another one so early in the season. I mean, is this the fixture we all wanted to see, Greg?
Not really. I mean, it is in the draw, but it's still going to be Man City reserves against Man United reserves, I fear. We've already had one Manchester derby where we saw City almost destroy United 2-1, if you could say that, thrash them 2-1. I don't think we're going to be able to read too much from this game. We know Mourinho likes the League Cup and he wants to win every competition. I wonder whether Guardiola will take it quite so seriously. But in terms of bragging rights and all that kind of stuff, I don't think it's as big as it could have been.
Adrian, another big game in the next round is going to be Liverpool versus Spurs. And that's a fixture that hasn't really ignited in the way people expected to in, well, the recent times they've played each other. Do you reckon this could be a bit different this time? Both teams are kind of maturing a bit under their two managers.
I think they are, but listening to what Mauricio Pochettino was saying last night after Spurs beat Gillingham 5-0, he was sort of suggesting that he's still going to stick with some of those kids that he played against Gillingham last night. So that will take a bit of an edge off the game in terms of, again, anyone being able to read anything into it. And Pochettino was saying quite rightly, Liverpool don't have European competition this year, so they will probably take this competition a bit more seriously than he will in terms of the strength for their team. So I don't think there'll be a massive edge on this one either, actually.
And how did Spurs do without Harry Kane? Because obviously he's such a big part of how they play. Did Vincent Janssen fill his shoes adequately?
In some senses, yes, but in some senses, no. He certainly had a lot of chances. Some of his runs were great, his hold up play was great, his interplay and link up with his teammates was great, the positions he got into, but his finishing, I said it in my report, he basically left his shooting boots at home. His finishing was what let him down last night. He had five clear chances in the first half before he ended up scoring a penalty. So in some ways that there were great signs in terms of how he's going to fit into that side and how Spurs can continue without Harry Kane and how they'll be without Harry Kane, but ultimately it's the goals that you want to see from him. And then when you see him miss five chances, there's still that little concern about whether he'll be able to fill the void. But it's only Gillingham, it's only a League Cup game. It was only his first, effectively his first chance to fill in for Kane. So time will tell.
Absolutely. And two of the big shocks, I guess, in the League Cup, there's always a shock in a cup round, Hush, was Bournemouth and Everton both losing out. I mean, is this just the standard fare in a cup competition, or are there kind of signs of weakness in those two teams?
I don't think it's a sign of weakness. I think both of those teams played heavily rotated sides. Both of them have, their priorities are in the Premier League. The Everton game was a bit weird in a sense. The atmosphere at Goodison Park was strange after Naismith scored, but I don't think either of those two will put too much impetus on how important that defeat was. It's they got bigger fish to fry in other competitions.
Absolutely.
I was just going to say, I really don't know what Ronald Koeman was doing, making six changes. And Everton had so much momentum going into the game. They haven't won a trophy since 1995. And he did this with Southampton as well. Didn't take the cups seriously enough. And it was a really good opportunity for Everton to win this cup. We've been talking about United and City playing each other. There's one of those out. Liverpool, Tottenham. So the competition is going to open up. And it was a really good opportunity for Everton to build on the momentum and to win a cup. And I think he threw it. And I'm pretty disappointed in him, actually.
I was at Bournemouth on Tuesday night and Eddie Howe made 11 changes. And when you look at that, you think, oh, he's not taking the competition seriously. But then when they lost to Preston and we spoke to him afterwards, he was furious. He was talking about how he doesn't give chances to effectively his backup players lightly. And he played those players because he felt they deserved it. And he was so angry that they let him down. And you wonder if, you're talking about complacency. I don't think it was complacency from him. I think he expected those players to be good enough to win that game. And when they didn't, I think, and the way they performed as well, it was quite a lackluster performance. He used the word lethargic to describe them at the start. I think the impact of that will be some of those players will be struggling to get in that first team anytime soon.
Mm. Well, Bournemouth almost seen as like an attacking version of Burnley, where they've got quite a small squad. They don't rotate much. They're all built around their plan A. So, I mean, maybe that is actually maybe a sign of weakness if they have any injuries this season. If they haven't got the players that are motivated and ready to step in, that could be a problem for them, Adrian.
And I think it would have been motivation more than anything else the other day, because it's not such an issue of quality. You know, the team was still worth 50 million that he played on Tuesday night. And you would expect them to be good enough to beat a championship side. But, you know, there were players in there like Gradle, you know, Mings, who's just coming back from injury, so he may not be pushing for a place just yet. Mm. Phoebe was up front, hardly had a kick. You know, there's some decent names in there that really didn't press their claims when they had a chance.
Mm. Interesting as well. There's always, in a League Cup round, there's always seems to be some fixtures that repeat themselves almost. It's quite odd. I mean, we saw City take on Swansea City, and they're going to play each other again in the Premier League. And Bristol City took on Fulham, and they're also going to play each other again this weekend in the Championship. I mean, is this just a weird coincidence that keeps happening in Horsham, or is it, you know, the fixture computer trying to make things happen?
I don't think we can delve into conspiracy theories or anything like that just yet. You saw Newcastle played Wolves as well, so that's three games. It happens a lot. It happens in European competitions as well, I seem to notice. But
Atletico and Real Madrid was it Barcelona and Real Madrid had some kind of run a few years ago where they were just playing each other every week.
What it does is it brings like an intriguing series of matches together. So you have league matches and cup matches, and you sort of see the different tactics that the managers bring in both. But apart from that, there's nothing too much we can read into that.
Do you think there's any advantage to a team like Swansea or City or Bristol or Fulham seeing an opponent a few weeks before they're going to play them in like a league match? Do you see any insights in how they can get around them? Or, as like you say, is it with rotated size?
It can be useful for the weaker team. So in the cup, it's knockout competition, so you have to go for the win. But if the league match follows, the weaker team can sort of tailor their tactics to perhaps sort of play for a draw, if you will, and sort of get an insight into what the opposing team can sort of offer in an attacking sense, and sort of work that out, and have 90 minutes to sort of almost have a pre-training session on the pitch to work out how to stop the attack.
I think Francesco Guidolin will struggle to find any positives to play in Man City twice in such quick succession. They've not won a league game since the first day of the season. I saw them at Southampton last weekend on Sunday. They were poor. And just, again, speaking to him afterwards, I think the last thing he would have wanted was two games, you know, against Man City. So I feel a little bit for him.
Absolutely. And there's rumours that on the Swansea front, Ryan Giggs is being touted as a potential replacement for Guidolin. Greg, do we think that's got any legs? Do you think it might be a good move for the Swans?
Well, I haven't heard anything, but it'd make an awful lot of sense, wouldn't it? Giggs, a Welshman, Hugh Davis, you would think would be...
Bit of a Cardiff boy, though, isn't he, really, Giggsy?
Yeah, but he's looking for a project as well. He said that. I mean, that's the kind of club he needs to be going into, a Swansea or a top championship club. Will they give him time is the question. You know, Gary Monk was so harshly treated by Swansea when you look back on it, which is why you'd think Guidolin's not got a lot of time, because Swansea have history as well. But if they can build something with Giggs and give him a few years, got to stay up first, I think it'd make a lot of sense. Mm.
Adrian, Swansea seems to be in a bit of a weird place. I mean, last summer we'd heard that Bielsa might be coming in, or some other really extravagant, really exciting managerial signings. But obviously that hasn't happened. But do you think they're setting their sights correctly? Do you think they're the project still got the legs it did a few years back, when they really seem to be going on the up and up every single season?
I think one of the big issues with Swansea, losing Monk and then losing Williams, and obviously the takeover as well, there's just a bit of a lack of identity about them. You go down there and not that there's any issue with having any foreign players, but there's just no identity there, you know? And I just don't quite really know where they're going. Guidolin's having the problem now with dissent, basically, that he's seen from a couple of his players in the last two games, Neil Taylor against Chelsea and Ki Sung Jung against Southampton. So it's all just a bit up in the air. It's not really too sure where they're going. And obviously now the stories are coming out about Guidolin. That's a situation that they got to get resolved, you know, quickly, one way or the other, if it's backing him and letting everyone know he's going to be the manager or maybe changing things.
So, I mean, if identity is a problem, maybe Leon Britton should be a player manager for a bit, because he you know, embodies the Swansea way, if you will. But, I mean, two managers that are also trying to get their team moving this season, obviously Arsene Wenger and Antonio Conte. Arsenal versus Chelsea is the big match this weekend, so we're going to preview it. It's the big game. Everyone's going to be talking about it. Fourth versus fifth. Are both clubs at the same level? Are they going after the same objectives this season, Stopes?
Yeah, I mean, they've both had pretty similar starts to the season, haven't they? They've won the games you'd expect them to win, not necessarily being convincing. Chelsea, a couple of last-minute winners. Arsenal, last-minute winner as well against Southampton. They both got played off the park by Liverpool. And there's definitely flaws. I don't think either of these teams are going to win the title from what we've seen so far this season. But it should be an exciting open game. Lots of defensive flaws in both teams. And Chelsea have a great record against Arsenal, don't they? And Diego Costa loves to score against them and to wind them up. So I think that could be crucial because he's on great form at the moment.
Absolutely. He is actually current joint top scorer in the Premier League with Michael Antonio, both with 5 goals. Weirdly, though, it's a bit of a swap between the identities you expect of both teams. Chelsea have created second most chances in the Premier League this season so far. Arsenal down in 9th for that statistic. While Chelsea conceded 6 goals, Arsenal 7. So quite close in terms of defensive stability, but Chelsea seems to be creating more chances.
Yeah, they are. I mean, it's obviously a different formation that Conte's playing than maybe like the 4-2-3-1 that we've seen before. It seems a bit more of a 4-1-4-1, a bit more attacking maybe than also what we expected from him. And the other thing as well is some of their attacking players, I'm looking at Hazard, I'm looking at Costa in particular, have sort of rediscovered some of the form that went missing last year. So attacking-wise, obviously, we're seeing a little bit more from Chelsea this year.
Got a great stat here. Fabregas has created 5 chances in just 39 minutes of Premier League football. And I think after his 2 goals against Leicester, I think we saw last season you can't really trust him in that too. But certainly instead of Oscar and a number 10, surely it's time for Cesc Fabregas to play. I think every Chelsea fan wants to see him play now. So there are a couple of big selection decisions to come this weekend. Xhaka surely going to start for Arsenal. He's bossing the games when he's on. I think better pass completion than anyone else in the league. So a couple of big selection decisions that could make the difference at the weekend.
But it's been a little bit surprising that Fabregas maybe hasn't played in some of the games against, and I hope I don't offend anyone, but slightly lesser opposition. I can understand why Mourinho last year, for example, and Conte this year would maybe against tougher opposition not trust him to do the defensive work. And that's why, for example, Matic would get the nod. But, Swansea away, for example, Fabregas could have easily played that West Ham at home, maybe their first game of the season. Fabregas could have been involved in that game because it's quite obvious what he brings. And obviously we saw it again the other night of his 2 goals against Leicester.
When Fabregas is playing with a 2 of Batshuayi and Costa, Chelsea have looked the most potent. If you look at second half against Watford when they scored, was it 3 goals in the last couple of minutes? Second half and extra time against Leicester the other night. I think Matic and Kante, it's sort of too many cooks. Neither of them are sort of controlling the game. The first half against Liverpool, they got, torn apart. The Liverpool midfield, all 4 of them, were just all over Matic and Kante. Kante, he's doing more passing than ever before. Leicester last season, he was more of a ball winner. Now he's got more time on the ball. He's looking up. He's only seeing Costa making runs against a back 4 on his own. Oscar, like Greg mentioned, his sort of stock is falling quicker than anyone else in the Chelsea team at the moment.
I think Conte quite likes him, though. He has said
he does, because Oscar is the sort of player where he plays in the attacking third, but he does a defensive role. He's sort of a destroyer from the front. He tackles and closes people down. I think only Firmino had more tackles than him in the opposition half last season. So you can see the value Oscar does offer, but it's not working for Chelsea at the moment. So they need to change something. And yeah, I wouldn't be completely surprised if Conte really went for it and put both of them up front at the Emirates on Saturday.
Be interested to see if that works, though, because only Manchester City have completed more passes than Arsenal this season. Chelsea are in third for that. Do you think it would be a case of Arsenal keeping the ball from the Blues and then make it, even if they've got a numerical advantage up front, they can't quite get the ball to their players and maybe that might backfire against them?
I think that will probably be the story of the game. I think Arsenal will be dominating the possession and Chelsea will look for those sort of counter breaks and those sort of those clutch moments where Diego Costa can make the difference. One of the themes that I wanted to touch on Arsenal versus Chelsea for the last 18 months or since Costa's arrived is Costa isolating one of our centre-backs and absolutely making a meal of him. He tried it against Koscielny first off and it didn't sort of work out, but since then he's got Mertesacker sent off in the Emirates last season, got Gabriel sent off at the Stamford Bridge last season as well. So Mustafi has got a lot of work ahead of him on Saturday. If he plays against Koscielny, you can guarantee Costa's going to be up and in his face. On the ball, Mustafi's been very good. He's completed more passes than any other player in the whole match that weekend for the Premier League. But off the ball, he's been a little bit suspect. He's still sort of getting to know his defensive partner and his fullbacks. And I think the Costa-Mustafi sort of head-to-head battle is going to be decisive.
If Costa's going to be the danger man for Chelsea, Alexis Sanchez has been playing up front instead of Olivier Giroud for Arsenal. Do you think his movement, looking at how Liverpool took Chelsea apart, do you think having that kind of unorthodox centre forward rather than a big solid target man like Olivier Giroud might be actually more dangerous for Chelsea to deal with, Adrian?
I mean, obviously John Terry is touch and go for this weekend. I'm not too sure whether he's going to play, but a forward like Giroud, effectively plays into the hands of Gary Cahill and John Terry. It's the sort of forward that they would like to deal with.
Mm.
It's the physical side of the game, which they both relish. It's going up and winning headers. Somebody's not very quick. You know, he's not going to trouble them with particularly his movement or anything like that. So Sanchez would be, you know, Wenger and Arsenal got a very poor recent record against Chelsea. It's one win in the last eight, I think, and they've not scored in the last six league games, which goes back three seasons. So something to look at this morning. Didn't realise how bad it actually was. But he's going to have to come up with something to try and, you know, to throw Chelsea, basically, and try and outwit them. Sanchez, he played up front against Liverpool in the first game of the season, and he was basically non-existent.
Yeah.
But I think he's slowly warming to that role as the season has gone on. Obviously, as I imagine, he's getting fitter as well.
Mm.
So he could be the sort of forward that they would need to trouble Chelsea and give them something a little bit different to think about.
I still don't like Sanchez down the middle. I think he's better off the left. You mentioned the Liverpool game. I don't think he's been good there at all this season, really. You look at the PSG game, couldn't get any space, moved out to the left, and he snuck into some space.
Yeah.
A bit like Cristiano Ronaldo at Real Madrid, you can see the game and you can move into space. And if you want someone to occupy the defenders, it doesn't have to be Giroud. It could be Lucas Perez. It could be Theo Walcott even.
Mm.
I think if Alexis Sanchez is your best goal scorer, he's proven coming in off the left. That's his position. That's where he's going to score goals.
It's very interesting generally what's going on with Arsenal up front and why Giroud has not actually got a look in this season. You know, all the other players who played in the Euros now, they're all fit, they're all playing. Mm. So the Giroud situation is very interesting, especially as he's not, you know, he's brought in Lucas Perez. And if Wenger had said, okay, well, I'm going to play Lucas Perez, yeah, fair enough.
Yeah,
he's not doing that. So it's really strange. It's a really strange situation.
The numbers tell a really sort of interesting story with the Giroud-Sanchez conundrum. Without Giroud, Arsenal create less chances, but our conversion rate is much, much higher. So with Giroud up front, he creates more chances for the likes of Sanchez and Walcott, but his finishing, as we all sort of learn over the last couple of years, it's not up to scratch, so he misses a lot of good chances. Whereas Sanchez, playing up front, we don't tend to create as many chances, but we've got 43% chance conversion. That's 9 goals out of 21 shots on target. That's absurdly high.
Yeah. So, but is that sustainable then?
Yeah, it's maybe not. But with Sanchez playing up front, it creates a bit of room for Alex Iwobi to play on the left instead of him, who's been one of the shining lights of Arsenal season so far. Walcott plays more of a right winger role rather than getting himself into the box too much and sort of supporting his right back, Bellerin, which he's done quite well so far this season. So I could see Wenger's thinking in terms of how it helps other parts of the team. But like the guys mentioned, if you're not creating the chances, you can't sustain that sort of chance conversion rate. So yeah, we'll see what happens.
It wasn't just Cahill and Luiz as well, and Ivanovic, that looked a bit suspect in their previous Premier League loss. It was also Dave, says Azpilicueta, who everyone used to see as like the best defender in the Premier League, as Gary Neville put it. Is there a real chance that Chelsea might just, you know, not turn up at the back again?
Well, I mean, they've got Marcus Alonso, haven't they, who they played against Leicester. He's a natural left back. Azpilicueta, despite how well he's done playing at left back for Chelsea, seeing off Ashley Cole first of all, and then Philippe Luiz, Babarraman, give him an honourable mention as well. You know, despite how well he's played at left back, he is naturally a right back. So maybe, and obviously Ivanovic has struggled generally for the last sort of year, 18 months. So maybe bringing in that natural left back may help shore things up. But, you know, I think it's Terry's the big miss. He's the kind of glue that knits everything together.
Mm.
I think maybe if you get a natural left back and Terry back fit for this weekend, it will make a big difference.
I think a Conte team with, you know, like you said, Azpilicueta on the right and with Matic and Kante in front of them shouldn't have too many problems defensively. David Luiz didn't look too good against Leicester, but you've got to give him a bit of time for Conte to get into him. But I can't see it being a high-scoring game, to be honest. These games are usually, I mean, Chelsea absolutely thrashed them a couple of times, didn't they? The 6-0. But I can't see it being too high-scoring. A couple of goals in it, really.
Well, Chelsea's other danger men, besides Diego Costa, obviously it's Willian and Eden Hazard. Willian's created the most chances per night of any Premier League player this season, and only Adnan Januzaj has completed more take-ons than Eden Hazard of players who've actually started at least one game. But is it going to be a case of them having to drop back and do defensive work to protect their fullbacks as well?
I'm quite surprised by those stats because I thought they were rubbish against Liverpool. both of them. I mean, Chelsea are set up for the counter-attack, you're right. Mm. And, you know, it's a bit Mourinho-esque against Arsenal. You sit back, you get behind the ball. The plan is keep them quiet for half an hour, frustrate them and hit them on the counter-attack. And if you've got Eden Hazard, Willian, Oscar, Fabregas playing three balls, Costa, Batshuayi. Chelsea are so well set up to hit Arsenal on the counter-attack, to isolate, like Hush was saying earlier, you isolate Mustafi one-on-one and then they've got a problem.
I think if Conte's done his homework, which I imagine he has, he's going to have Willian pegging Monreal right back into his half, because you saw against PSG in the Champions League, Liverpool did it in the first match of the season. Everyone seems to be targeting that left-hand side of Arsenal's defence, with Bellerin bombing on the right. And so Monreal's had a really sort of indifferent start to the season. For the last two campaigns before this, he's arguably been our most consistent performer. He's been sort of going under the radar a little bit, just week in, week out, putting in 8 out of 10 performances. But this season, he's just, I don't know whether it's the tactics, whether it's the midfield not sort of covering him, but he's dropped off massively. And I think if Conte's sort of not with that trend across the first few games of the season, then Chelsea will really sort of concentrate on exposing him.
So both sides could be trying to get each other's left-backs into trouble, basically.
That's a good point. And on Manreal, he doesn't get a lot of help either, whether it's Iwobi or Alexis Sanchez.
He's often the one giving help to the centre-backs as well.
And you you can get him 2-on-1 as well, and that's a problem.
Adrian, we talked about the players, but how will Conte's arrival affect the dynamic between Wenger and the Chelsea manager? There's always been a little bit of a rivalry there. I mean, dating back probably to the Jose Mourinho stint.
Yeah, I think that's the big thing is Jose Mourinho. I think Conte's arrival should take the sting out of it, out of the rivalry, certainly on the touchlines anyway, quite significantly, because a lot of the edge was because of the dislike between Mourinho and Wenger. I mean, Conte, don't worry, he's as we all know, he's a feisty character himself. But just looking at how we dealt with the Mazzarri situation, Walter Mazzarri, obviously the Watford manager, there's bad blood between those two. Both come to the Premier League, and speaking to Conte before that game, you know, we were asking him about it and he was really trying to play it down. He said, I've come to a new country now, you know, effectively start my relationships afresh. What happened with Mazzarri was because Juventus and Napoli were going head to head for the title, and over time that relationship and that animosity builds up. But he says, here, you know, it's brand new, we all start afresh. So I can't imagine he's got any issues with Wenger at the moment. So I imagine that relationship will, certainly for now, maybe until his time here builds up.
See by Monday.
Maybe he's going head-to-head for things with Wenger. Maybe then there'll be some animosity between them.
Yeah, definitely. And Greg, we've talked in the past about what Abramovich is looking for from his Chelsea manager. I mean, in Mourinho's second stint, he wanted him to be this empire builder, to really lay down like a dynasty. In the past, he looked for that maybe in Scolari and how he wanted to change the way the club play football. I mean, you look at what Conte did at Juventus. He built them back up into the biggest team in Italy. But looking over to the Emirates, is this about Wenger that Abramovich might want to see in his future Chelsea managers? Like a guy who can build an actual kind of lasting thing that's kind of self-sustaining at Stamford Bridge?
Well, I think he says that Abramovich, I mean, Pep Guardiola was his dream, and it's the same kind of concept as with Conte. They've got the best academy in the country. They win absolutely everything. Got so many young kids coming through, but the difficult thing is to actually make footballers out of them. And so many of them have failed to make it now, and they've got such a good young bunch that I think he wants a manager who can see them through for the next 4 or 5 years, a bit like Pochettino at Tottenham perhaps as well.
Well, there were rumours that Chelsea were interested in getting him in as well, weren't
they? I think they were, but Abramovich, for all his talk about this kind of stuff, he's impatient. So you lose a few games and you're out, and that's what we see. Mourinho's their most successful manager ever. As bad as it was last year, he didn't have a problem getting rid of him. He's done it too many times in the past, so you know you don't have a chance. So you don't play the kids, because if you lose a couple of games, you're under pressure already. And I think that's always been the problem at Chelsea, and it always will be while Roman Abramovich owns the club.
I think the other thing about empire builders and looking at Wenger as well, and Hush will probably be a better person arguably to speak about this, is for all Wenger's great work, the trophies haven't really come. So, you know, you ask a football fan, do you want somebody who's going to be there for ages, who's going to keep your bank balance, you know, looking good, maybe not win anything, but your club's going to be stable? You know, some fans may rather have the unrest that Chelsea have had, but all the silverware.
That's one thing I have noticed looking at social media. Arsenal fans saying, like, look at the consistency Wenger's had, but then some people have responded, yeah, but we kind of want the peaks and troughs. We want the flights of fantasy and then the fights against relegation and stuff like that.
Yeah, Wenger's stayed mainly because he lines the board's pockets every summer with Champions League qualification, the stadium regeneration and all of that stuff. In between sort of the trophyless period, or without the two FA Cups, without any Premier League or European success, Chelsea have won titles. They've dropped out of the top four, been back in the top four, won a Champions League, dropped out of the top four again, almost got relegated and got a new manager in. So I think Chelsea fans wouldn't really take 20 years of consistent sort of Champions League qualification over sort of peaks and troughs.
Mm.
And it's the off the pitch stuff that's kept Wenger at Arsenal more than anything. Mm. If we hadn't been doing so well off the pitch, there's no chance Wenger would have sort of been given the free reign he has over the last decade or so.
Mm. He's approaching 20 years now, Wenger, isn't it? And the last title was 2004. 12 years ago.
Yeah.
And there's no, I can't think of any other clubs at the top that would have.
Yeah.
Exactly. You look at Man United, you know, they think they're, you know, they.
Mourinho's already in trouble.
It's the same thing. Yeah. Well, they pride themselves on, you know, giving managers time and building something. Well, you did it when you had Sir Alex Ferguson, the best manager ever. Mm. You didn't do it when you had David Moyes and Louis van Gaal. And like you said, Mourinho already, people moaning about him. So, yeah, I think Wenger's going to be the last one, really, isn't he? As soon as he goes, you know it's going to be 2 or 3 years per manager at Arsenal.
This team, the one he's building now, it has to be his final one. He's had a few previous teams from like 07, 08 to the team in 2010 to the one just got dismantled before that. Those teams he built up to just challenge for the title, get close to them, but then they got, you know, the best players got pinched by our rivals. Van Persie, Fabregas, all these guys left the club. This one, we're finally in a position where, you know, we're not a selling club anymore. Every summer, we're not sort of, you know, dreading, Arsenal fans are not dreading losing Ozil or Sanchez. Not yet, anyway.
You will be.
Yeah. if we don't sort of press on now. But this is, you know, finally in the last 2 years or so, we've got to a stage where we're building and getting sort of, the squad is improving year on year, and it's not sort of being ripped up and built together again. So it's now or never, really, for Wenger. I say the next season or two, and that's it. That's all she said.
Well, on that note, I'm going to ask you, would you rather, the two options are, would you rather be at one club for 20 years, one big club, I should say, at 20 years, or manage as many top sides as possible in that time? I guess we're comparing Wenger with Ancelotti in some ways here. So which one would you be, Adrian?
I think I'd rather hop around.
Yeah?
Have some fun at all the big clubs, yeah. I think I'd rather do that than, because ultimately, yeah, as you say, we're looking at Wenger. Would I rather be Wenger or Ancelotti? I'd rather be Ancelotti.
Yeah, fair enough. Greg?
I'd rather be at one club, you know, be the club legend, the Totti, the Wenger, the Fergie. I think that's where you really create a dynasty and have a legacy.
But with no trophies, like Wenger.
Well, it doesn't have to be like Wenger. It can be.
Okay. If I could be Fergie, I'll be Fergie. If I have to be Wenger, I'd rather be someone else.
Or should you have to do the signing very?
I absolutely adore Wenger, but I'm going to have to say Ancelotti as well. The sort of the glamour and the glitz of going from the big club to big club, winning European trophies everywhere. How can you turn that down?
I can't help but feel I've kind of, you know, poisoned the world by bringing Ancelotti into this, because who wouldn't want to be Ancelotti? Yeah. The guy who was good in Leiden.
No, but even like I was thinking of Ranieri in my head. Mm. He's been to like a handful of big clubs from like Juve to Valencia.
And had a fairy tale as well.
Yeah, so. And he's had his fairy tale as well. And you've had your ups and downs, and you learn a bit more about the game, I think, sort of going from league to league and experiencing different styles of play, players and cultures and what have you.
Mm.
So yeah, I'd say sort of skipping around the leagues for me.
I think as well, the managers who do move around and achieve success, it's a great endorsement for their methods that you can do it at multiple clubs. You know, basically everything is, again, we say Wenger, everything is set up for him as he wants.
Mm. I don't know, Monaco, Grandpa Seven, you know?
Well, but we're talking about he's 20 years old, Arsenal, for example.
If you take the Guardiola example, when he was at Bayern last season, a lot of sort of Fairweather fans sort of saying, oh, he's, you know, a bit overrated, easy league, easy team to sort of drive up to the title, go out in the semis in the Champions League. He's come to Man City to try and prove a point, and within what, a month and a half, he's sort of, everyone sort of sees him as a genius already.
Mm.
So when you're proving yourself in different sort of environments again and again, I think it puts more sort of, it leaves a bigger legacy in some ways, but I do get what Stelbar is saying in terms of a one club man, you go down in history, have a statue, that sort of thing.
It's all a bit Football Manager, isn't it?
Really? Yeah.
But yeah, before we start hopping around Europe, we're just going to quickly look at the other Premier League games of note coming up this weekend. Obviously, Manchester United play the reigning champions Leicester City at Old Trafford, a return for Danny Drinkwater and Danny Simpson to their old stomping ground. More woe for Jose Mourinho. What are we expecting from this game, Adrian?
Do you know what? I really can't call Man United games at the moment. I know obviously they've beaten off beat Northampton last night, but you just don't know what to expect. I mean, they really just look still like a Van Gaal team. It's just no urgency, no pace in the side, no intensity. And obviously they're coming up against a side who last year at least were the complete opposite of that. And, you know, I imagine Leicester will go to Old Trafford. They won, they're champions, and two, the way Man United are playing, they got no reason to fear go into Old Trafford. The onus is really on Mourinho to get things clicking there, work out how to get the best out of Paul Pogba, start winning games, playing good football, and start looking like a side who costs as much as they do.
Mm-hmm. Stopes, I mean, some of the talk around United has been that it's not so much that they're playing the wrong system, not really playing a system at all. Mourinho is basically setting out the team to, you know, defend a bit and then just letting the individuals get on with it, which is a little bit Moisean. Is it? Have you heard anything about the details of what's going on over at Old Trafford?
You sent a tweet out saying pretty similar, didn't you?
Might have done.
Great. No, I haven't, but Mourinho's stance is that it's going to take some time, and he's been given a bit of a hospital pass by Moyes and Van Gaal, and it takes more than a couple of months. But when you spent £90 million on one player and you've started the season well, people expect more. And you look at the individuals in United's team, and you would have thought the one thing Mourinho would do would be to turn them into a team that had defined roles and knew what they were doing. Mm. And if you don't know what you're going to do with a £90 million footballer, and if you can't drop your captain for no apparent reason, then you've got a problem. And I think maybe he can make some big decisions this weekend, maybe play 4-3-3, maybe drop Rooney and really stamp his authority, not just on that match, but on the club, because we've seen Guardiola do it. And Mourinho's been a bit within himself, a bit timid so far.
A couple of things I'd add. Greg's obviously touched on one of them. Rooney, he shouldn't be in the team. Basically, this was all I'll add to what Greg said, but I totally agree with what he said. Secondly, the treatment of Michael Carrick is quite strange. He really fought to get Michael Carrick a new contract. You know, he was expecting to leave until basically Mourinho said, no, stay, we're going to give you another year. Played him in the Community Shield. I think he told Carrick he was going to build his team around him. You know, he was going to be one of the fulcrums of the team. And then he's hardly played him, obviously, up until last night. He's trying to find a way to get the best out of Paul Pogba. And I think you do need somebody who's disciplined, who can control a game of football, which is not essentially what Paul Pogba does. But, you know, Carrick will be that presence in front of the back four, which is an inexperienced back four as a unit as well. And just give United a bit of a platform. So I would expect, I'd be very surprised if he doesn't include Carrick in that team, possible new look team that he plays against Leicester.
One of my worries about Mourinho, I mean, it's very early days, but he's already sort of railing against the media, you know, oh, everyone's forgotten the last 14 years of my career and stuff. And we saw he had a breakdown last year, the last few months of the season. He lost the players completely by screaming and shouting at them. It was the Eva Carneiro incident. In public, he was slamming his players. We saw him do it last week with Luke Shaw as well. So how much has he really learnt? 1 week of pressure and he's already reverting to type, Mourinho, and, you know, the sociopathic Mourinho almost. And that would be my worry at the moment, because United would have hoped that he would rein himself in, that he might have learnt the lessons, but has he really?
I think, as Adrian was pointing out, Carrick, I think, is the answer on two fronts. He could play the defensive midfield role or the ball-playing deep-lying role that Pogba's been sort of shoehorned into, and it'd solve he could push Pogba up into the number 10 position, get Rooney out of the team. Then you've got dictation from deep, you've got a bit of penetration up front, you've got Rooney and Ibrahimovic has not clicked. There's not been any sort of chemistry, bar the Southampton game when putting a few good crosses from a wide position.
Kind of reminds me of Van Persie and Rooney. They were both kind of trying to do the same thing all the time,
but
not quite quick enough
to do it. Van Persie and Rooney, they seemed to sort of click once or twice in a match and score a goal and sort of collect the 3 points. I think that's kind of what Mourinho was going for, but it just hasn't come to fruition. So I think Pogba and Ibrahimovic, they seem to have this sort of chemistry between them. You saw in a couple of post-match interviews that, you know, they look good friends or whatever. I think that has to be, you have to put all your eggs in that basket because no other plan seems to be working.
We've said a bit about United there, but we can't forget the reigning champions, Leicester City. They've also got a few players of their own that could really turn the game. Ahmed Musa looked fantastic.
Musa looks fantastic. He played quite well in the first half when Chelsea gave him a whole lot of space in the EFL Cup the other week. I think that's Slimani, who's added a completely new dimension to their attacking sort of triumvirate. Joa last season was sort of playing in that role, being the sort of buffer to Mahrez and Vardy. But, you know, he's come from the Championship. He did, he won the title, but he wasn't at that sort of high level. He wasn't sort of converting chances or beating players or what have you. I think Slimani is a massive upgrade. And in his debut, he scored 2 goals, linked up with Vardy, and Mahrez already looks like he's sort of, you know, built up a relationship with him. So, yeah, I think Mourinho's, a lot of his work, you know, as we were saying, is about finding the right sort of equation going forward. But he's better do some homework on Leicester's attack. Otherwise, you know, there could be another upset at Old Trafford.
Absolutely. Another manager who's going to have to do his homework and get his work out this weekend is a Mark Hughes. I mean, only Man City are scoring more goals at a faster rate than Stoke City are conceding them at the moment in the Premier League. And the Potters have conceded the most goals of any team in Europe's top five leagues. If Tony Pulis beats his old side, is that curtains for Mark Hughes?
I would hope not. I was talking to somebody about this last night. You know, Mark Hughes has done very well to move Stoke on from that Tony Pulis era. Maybe three ninth place finishes under him doesn't quite do the work that he's done justice. But I would hope that the 3 years of work that he's put in has earned him enough credit for them to back him through what's obviously a storm at the moment. And just give him time to try and turn it around. You know, some of their signings were interesting, exciting upgrades that you thought would make a difference. Boney coming in on deadline day. Martins, indeed, a defender. Obviously, Joe Allen as well, after a good Euros. So he's got the pieces there. Just needs to make it work. I mean, maybe when you look at what's going on with Stoke at the moment, there was something in what Mark Wilson was saying, who obviously got sold on to Bournemouth for questioning Mark Hughes' his defensive training. And obviously, look at the goals they're conceding, and you see the stats you just read out there. Maybe there is something in that, and that's something they got to look at. But as I said, I just hope that the 3 years' work that he's done there will just buy him a little bit more time to sort things out.
I actually agree with Adrian on that one, but the problem is momentum, isn't it? And when the momentum starts going that way, it's very hard to turn it around when you're shipping four goals every game.
Especially when Nasser Chadli's coming at you with two goals against West Brom.
I mean, the other thing, Hughes didn't necessarily get the players he wanted. You know, if he got Sacco in there and missing Jack Butland is the biggest miss by Marge. Shay Given, every time I watch Match of the Day, at least two or three of the goals you think Butland would have saved.
A good stat on Shay Given, he's made 15 appearances, it might be 16 now, for Stoke. He's yet to keep a clean sheet. That sort of shows how bad it is.
And last season, I mean, Butland kind of announced himself to the Premier League by keeping Stoke in a lot of games that they deserve to lose, actually.
They were solid. They were solid when he was there.
I expected Tony Pulis to come out and defend Mark Hughes because the last 3 weeks he's had that sort of pressure on himself. After that 4-0 or 4-2 win against West Ham, he sort of explains how West Brom created more chances the week before but scored more goals this week, or last week, sorry. So he'll sort of, I think he'll come out and sort of tell a lot of people, put them in their place over, you know, putting Mark Hughes down a little bit.
It's a funny old game, I guess.
It is.
But also this weekend, the Premier League, we're also going to see Karanka versus Pochettino, battle of the former La Liga defenders. We've already talked about how Spurs are going to cope without Kane, but do Middlesbrough have the tools to set them apart, Stopes?
Potentially, a lot of it depends on Tottenham's injuries. We saw Moussa Dembélé and Eric Dier come off with hamstring injuries last week, and that's, you know, they're two starting.
I mean, without Dembélé, you don't have a midfield.
So if both of those are out, there's going to be space in between the lines. Even if Wanyama comes in, it'll probably be someone like Harry Winks or Dele Alli playing with him. And we saw when Alli played there in a two against Monaco, Monaco caught Spurs on the counter-attack. So if Middlesbrough are going to get a chance, you know, Gaston Ramirez picking up space in between. But if Dembele and Dier and all Dier are fit and Wanyama's in there too, I think Spurs will block Middlesbrough out and they should have the attacking quality to score a couple of goals.
Negredo, he's obviously going to be there as well. He's the big danger man for Middlesbrough. Do you think guys like Alderweireld, they've got enough about him to kind of see him off?
Yeah, I would have thought so. I mean, Alderweireld, in my opinion, last year was best central defender in the league, I would say. And obviously Vertonghen's back as well. Negredo, not the quickest again. You know, we were talking earlier on about Giroud up against Cahill and Terry, for example. I'd expect Vertonghen and Alderweireld to be able to deal similarly with the threat of Negredo. Interesting that he came back. Obviously, he started great at Man City, didn't he? And then he
His shoulder injury just completely knocked him out.
It was from February onwards, he didn't score a goal and didn't really pull up any great trees at Valencia. So I was quite surprised he got moved back to the Premier League. But he's obviously got a couple of goals already, made an impact. So he's obviously going to be the one shouldering the burden for Middlesbrough.
Absolutely.
I can see Negredo starting against Spurs, but I don't see him having too much success like Adrian mentioned against Vertonghen and Alderweireld. I kind of hope that if it doesn't work out somewhere in the match that Karanka will look to Fisher and Rhodes, because when they were signed, or when Fisher was signed in the summer, a lot of people are excited about seeing them two maybe as a two or see how that would develop. And then when Negredo came in, it sort of became clear that Alvaro Negredo is going to be the main man and you know, Rhodes is not going to get a look in. But I've been sort of waiting to see them in action or see how Middlesbrough would set up without Negredo with the two little men up front. maybe that might be a way to unlock Spurs if Spurs are going to set up to stop Negredo.
Mm. Almost like what we're talking about with Alexis Sanchez and
Chelsea.
Yeah,
almost the same sort of way. Just a plan B, basically,
The Jordan Rose situation is so interesting because he scored so many goals in the Championship and then moved to Middlesbrough. You thought, well, he's missed, the final piece for them. We'll get them up and then he'll finally get his chance in the Premier League.
Yeah. Mm.
And he just hasn't been able to get it. I mean, I was at the League Cup game when they went out to Fulham. In the build-up, Karanka was saying, I'm going to give Jordan Rose his chance. They were losing and he didn't get on.
Is he just too good for the Championship but not quite good enough for the Premier League, do you think? What is the reason? Ultimately,
that's the way it looks at the moment because he scored a lot of goals in the Championship and he's had his first crack at the Premier League and he's not been able to force his way into that side. So that is how it looks at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's the Premier League. We're going to move on now to Europe. Quick dash around the big leagues. Real Madrid drew with Villarreal in the week, so they couldn't actually beat the record of 16 straight wins they equaled, which was run up by Pep Guardiola's Barcelona, obviously. And in the aftermath of that, there was also Barcelona versus Atletico Madrid, 1-1. I mean, title race is still up for grabs in Spain, surely.
Oh, yeah, it's wide open. Atletico made a pretty poor start to the season. They really needed a result last night, and they got it. Mm. They were on the back foot for so long, and they sort of just waited it out, and Messi went off, Busquets went off, Mascherano was sort of off colour a little bit, and they just stuck in the game and got their just rewards. I think Diego Simeone is still sort of trying to build up a new sort of sense of motivation after getting so close last season to two big trophies and missing out. Mm. It's sort of like the reset button in the summer. It's hard to, go again, as everyone says, but I think there's signs are there. They got a big test against Bayern in midweek in the Champions League. Mm. They can get a result there, then I think they can slowly build some momentum and then maybe, take Barca and Real Madrid to the wire this season.
Stobes, on the Champions League coming up, Messi's irreplaceable, but so is Busquets. If they're both a doubt, well, and Messi's actually been ruled out, hasn't he?
He's ruled out for 3 weeks now.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's surely going to be a huge problem for Barcelona in Europe, especially.
How long's Busquets out for?
He signed a five-year deal just literally hours before we came on here. So
he's not going to go anywhere. He is literally, he's quite a unique player, isn't he?
He's the best midfielder in the world for me. Just his reading of the game, the way he dictates the play, absolutely everything. I mean, you can almost... silly to say, you can almost live without Messi in a Champions League group game because you've got Neymar and Suarez and the guys they bought. But without Busquets, you might be missing someone who can control the game. So I think he's actually, weirdly, in the Champions League, a bigger loss.
Mm-hmm. Going over to Italy now, Joe Hart, in his latest game for Torino, kept a clean sheet despite his team having two players sent off. And this weekend sees Torino take on Roma. It's going to be Hart versus Chesney. It's going to be the battle of the ex-Premier League goalkeepers.
It's the battle of two goalkeepers who think they're better than they are, isn't it? And they've both got a lot to say for themselves as well. And they both had their wings clipped a little bit, haven't they, in the last couple of years. But potentially Chesney and Hart are top goalkeepers at Champions League clubs. And a real chance for them both to show it this year because they kind of been shafted a little bit, haven't they?
Yeah, you wonder if they will both look at, down the other end of the pitch and think, how the hell have we found ourselves here? And there is a reason why we're here. And it's because, as Greg said, maybe there's a little bit of overconfidence from both of them. But yeah, that clean sheet for Joe Hart will do him wonders, obviously, after his debut, flapped at that corner and gifted, I can't remember their plan actually, but, obviously gifted opposition a goal. So he would have needed that clean sheet. So it'd be very interesting, what goes on at the two opposing ends of the pitch.
Mm, definitely, definitely. But I'm gonna put the question out to you all now. Game of the weekend, what is the match you're most looking forward to? Preferably not one of the big ones. We all heard about Arsenal versus Chelsea, but what are the matches that you'll be looking out for this weekend, Hush?
A little curveball here. I'm looking forward to Aston Villa versus Newcastle in the Championship because it's the first big game of the Championship season. Aston Villa sort of don't really know what they're doing. Rafa's got Newcastle on a bit of momentum. The Wolves result was a bit of a kick in the teeth, but they, got revenge in the cup in midweek. I think Newcastle could really hurt Villa and put a few past them, and that would sort of set the tone for the rest of the season. But if Villa were to pull off a result, if Di Matteo manages to find out what his strongest 11 is, gets the best out of Grealish and the rest of the sort of talent he's got at his disposal, then maybe Villa could sort of challenge Newcastle for the title this season. But yeah, I think that's going to be like a nice sort of milestone game to sort of to kick off the rest of the season, as it were.
Mm. Adrian, what's the match you're looking forward to?
He's nicked my idea. he's read my mind. I was looking at that game more because, we talk about Joe Hart and Chesney finding themselves in the division they do and the situation they do.
Mm.
pretty much the same for Villa and Newcastle, you know. Bizarrely, I ended up going to both of those two games last year when Villa and Newcastle played each other. Once because I was in Newcastle for the weekend and we got tickets. And the second time I was covering the game, which I think was the game at Villa Park, was when Villa actually, their relegation was pretty much confirmed that that day. So to see the obviously two massive clubs in the Championship, as great a game as it will be for the division, it's a bit of a, you know, bit of a realisation for both of them. If they didn't know already,
yeah,
that this should be a Premier League game, but it's not. So I'm looking forward to seeing how both of them get on at a weekend, and obviously for the rest of the season. With Villa, they've obviously got the Jack Grealish situation. He's been involved in more, got himself in another situation off the field. Obviously a great talent. We saw that, especially in that FA Cup semi-final against Liverpool, but he just seems to have issues off the field that are stopping him. I mean, when they went down, I just thought the Championship is going to be a chance for him to really build up some momentum in his career again and show everyone what he's about, because he didn't really build on that FA Cup semi-final performance. And now he's got more issues to deal with, so that'll be hanging over Villa going into the game.
Stan Collymore wrote an open letter to Grealish on social media last night, and let's see if Grealish has read it and taken some notes from it. So,
Stan Collymore, stand-up guy.
In fairness to him, it was coming from the right place. I think he was effectively saying,
don't do what I did.
Basically.
Okay, I haven't read it.
What's the match you're looking for? Forget the open letters. What's the match you're looking forward to?
I'll tell you what I'm looking forward to. West Ham, Southampton. Because at the moment, West Ham, I would love to play West Ham if I was a fan of any club or playing for any club, because it feels like they're going to lose every game. And we talked about the negative momentum with Stoke, but you know, these guys had to wait until the 96th minute to beat Accrington Stanley on Wednesday night, and they've been absolutely awful. The Olympic Stadium move so far has been a disaster with the stewarding issues. They got Chelsea coming there in the League Cup with 15% allocation. There could be an absolute nightmare there. Oh, it's just all going wrong. This dream move to Olympic Stadium is all going wrong. And you feel, you know, if they go 1-0 down or 2-0 down, the fans start turning on each other again, it could get really messy there. I wouldn't say I'm looking forward to it.
I was going
to
say, mate.
But it could be pretty interesting, because it's not a happy place at the moment.
There's some signs from Southampton as well that they're now starting to gel under Puel. So it took a little bit of time.
Yeah.
And they got the first win in the Europa League and then the first win in the league last week against Swansea, and then they won again last night. Charlie Austin's in the goals. I think he must finally have forced his way into that team. Puel just didn't seem like he wanted to pick him for a while.
Almost like a Jordan Rhodes thing all over again.
He's got 3-3 now.
Four, because he got two in the Europa League.
But he's in the sort of, he's had to prove his fitness to Claude Puel, who's been playing Shane Long up front. But Shane Long's finishing this season has been horrendous at the Emirates.
This season, it's it's what he is.
I was trying to give him the benefit of the doubt there, but yeah.
He's... You can combine Charlie Austin and Shane Long into one player, you get the ultimate strike.
You get Harry Kane. Honestly, you do.
And on that note, we're going to have to leave that there. But thank you once again for joining us. Greg, it's been a pleasure.
Cheers, Greg. Thanks,
Adrian,
for having me.
Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me again.
Push. Thank you once again.
Always a pleasure.
It is always a pleasure. Join us again for the next pod. I think Nick English will be joining us next week to host that one. Also, check out squawker.com for all our latest news, writing and analysis. Follow us on Twitter at Squawker and Squawker News, and also on Facebook as well. See you soon.